The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, I don't really understand that, because I think he would have to say it ceased to be in them with the birth of the first child, perhaps. But how about the sins committed between that first sin and that first individualization of the human nature? Well, I don't think Shedd answers that. But that is statement of the view, Gary. Human nature, as thus defined, is only an attribute or adjunct of each individual. And the whole of human nature in this case belongs equally and alike to each individual, as does the whole of the property or quality of rationality or immortality. Let me just interrupt. It would be the way we say, oh, he did that because that's human nature. You know, that's like humans, okay? Going on with the quote. Dr. Hodge, in his explanation of realism and his objections to it, so understands and defines human nature. He regards it as an adjunct of the individual, as something united with it. This is an erroneous definition. Human nature is a substance, not the property or quality of a substance. It is not the property or quality of an individual substance, but is itself a specific or general substance. Nor is it a specific or general substance added to or united with an individual, because the latter is only an individualized part of the former. Human nature is a specific or general substance created in and with the first individuals of a human species. Don't you love this generalized definition, as though there were more human species around? Okay. Human nature is a specific or general substance created in and with the first individuals of a human species, which is not yet individualized, but which by ordinary generation is subdivided into parts, and these parts are formed into distinct and separate individuals of the species. The one specific substance by propagation is metamorphosed into millions of individual substances or persons. An individual man is a fractional part of human nature, separated from the common mass, constituted a particular person, having all the essential properties of human nature. Well, in case you needed any, I want to call this objections to the view. I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't be so smug. I'm sure they're realists still. Okay, two in brackets. Objections to the view. And notice now, as I put these four objections on the screen here, that since my outline has inserted the one in brackets statement of the view and the two in brackets objections to the view, that these points that on the transparency have the one, two, three, and four in brackets have to become A, B, C, and D. I could afford the money for a new transparency, but I haven't. I figured you could work that out, okay? A in brackets, B in brackets, etc. We're on A in brackets. Those Christians who are attracted to this view are attracted by the claim that this view provides the basis for a proper and just imputation of Adam's sin. The view that we're going to look at next, the representative union, covenantal union view, is said to make that imputation of Adam's sin to his posterity merely an arbitrary act of God's sovereignty. So that the individual today might very properly object, how can I be held accountable for Adam's sin? I wasn't even there. I didn't have a thing to do with it. That's what the realist is trying to deal with, you see. Shedd writes, and I quote, page 63, "The inference that because God gratuitously imputes Christ's righteousness to Christ's people, he also gratuitously imputes Adam's sin to Adam's posterity is the same kind of fallacy that lies in the inference that because God works in the human will and to do that which is right, he also works in it to will and to do when it wills wrongly. And to argue that if gratuitous imputation is not true in the case of Adam's sin, it's not true in the case of Adam's righteousness, what Murray does with the analogy, okay? It's like arguing that if God is not the author of sin by direct efficiency, he's not the author of holiness by direct efficiency. Both errors proceed upon the false assumption that God sustains precisely the same relation to holiness and to sin. But holiness and sin are absolute and irreconcilable contraries, so that some things are true regarding holiness that are untrue regarding sin. God may be the author of holiness, but not of sin. God can give, that is, gratuitously and undeservedly impute righteousness, but he cannot unrighteousness. He can pronounce a man innocent when he is guilty because Christ has obeyed for him, but God cannot pronounce a man guilty when he is innocent because Adam disobeyed for him. End of the quote, page 63. Now, Berkauer today is greatly concerned, like Shedd, that the Federalist view, the representative view, presents man with, using the phrase that comes up again and again, an alien guilt. A guilt that is not really his own. Not only an alien sin, a peccatum alienum, but also an alien guilt. And that can cause man to blame somebody else for his plight. And Berkauer sees the realist sharing that wholesome concern. We mustn't, says Berkauer, let a man think that he can blame somebody else for his condemnation. Like Shedd, Berkauer insists that an alien guilt is not to be seen as the counterpart of an alien righteousness. An alien righteousness is the ground of justification, the righteousness of another, namely Christ, imputed to me. But, Berkauer insists, the sin and guilt of another is not the ground of my condemnation. And so, Berkauer has a lot of sympathy for realism in his book entitled Sin. And yet he concludes, and I quote, "A jealousy for the justice of God controls this theory of realism to such an extent that little appreciation is left over for the internal problems and the exegetical deficiencies." That's a quote from page 445. So Berkauer, though he's very sympathetic to the realists, ends up by saying, well, there's some real problems there. There are some biblical problems, and we can't overlook those. I think we have to ask this question. Does the realist notion really relieve the difficulty of the apparent injustice of our being held in any way accountable for the sin of Adam? I think the answer to that question is clearly no. You see, we're saying that realism really rests on the basis of its alleged ability to present justification, if we use that word in this context, for God's holding me accountable for the sin of Adam. I think it clearly fails to do what it says it does. How can an individual of a race bear the guilt of a sin in which he did not personally, voluntarily, as an individual, participate? And the realist, you see, must admit that he did not individually, personally, voluntarily participate in the sin of Adam. As Murray puts it on page 32, the sin of generic humanity, some abstract, invisible human nature there at the beginning, the sin of generic humanity is just as far removed from the individual sin of the members of posterity as is the sin of a representative head. Now, Anthony Hookham insists on page 159 that that objection can be answered, that realism fails in its purpose. But can it? I personally don't know how. try the realist explanation out on your unbelieving friends and see if they're satisfied that it provides a just and fair basis for the imputation to them of Adam's sin. See if they say, oh, well, now, sure, that's perfectly fair, perfectly understandable. I was there in that substance, you know, and sure, now I see why I'm guilty. I doubt it. I submit that any claim that the realist view presents an explanation of the involvement of the whole race in the pollution, guilt, and punishment of Adam's one sin that will be acceptable to the natural man as reasonable and just is a false claim. And if you answer me and say, well, the realist's concern is not so much to satisfy the unbeliever as it is to satisfy the Bible's own insistence on the perfect justice of our holy God, then I can only answer, where in the Scripture is that rationale given? And that gets us all the way down to the fourth objection, to take things out of turn, we'll get to that one, that the realist position just isn't found in the Bible. So if you say, I wasn't trying to satisfy the unbeliever, I was just trying to satisfy the Bible's own concept of the justice of God, I still would say, well, the Bible doesn't present that defense. Second objection. And this now is B in brackets. Four objections to the realist view. The second one, the argument that the realist view provides the only just and fair basis for the involvement of the race in Adam's sin fails to take into consideration the fact that the Bible teaches that there's a solidarity in responsibility and liability in other relationships in life where no such specific generic unity exists. The Bible lays stress on the corporate relationships such as family and nation. You know how the Bible talks about the sin down to the third and the fourth generation being held responsible, but how God's mercy will extend to thousands of generations of those that love Him and keep His commandments. At least I agree with those who read that text that way. Third and fourth generation, and the thousands are not just thousands of people, but thousands of generations. It seems quite proper and reasonable to apply the same principle of corporate responsibility to the whole race in Adam. And since no realistic union exists, obviously, in the family or in the nation, Shed isn't saying there's some kind of realistic union there. This is a sui generis, it only happens once. If it doesn't happen in those other relationships, there's no reason to insist that it must exist between Adam and his posterity, or God can't talk about corporate relationship. And then thirdly, and again, I still think importantly, the analogy that the Scripture institutes between Adam and Christ in Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15 presents a great difficulty to the realist view, in spite of Shed's attempt to turn aside its force. You remember how Shed says, well, what's true on the side of grace and holiness is not necessarily true on the side of sin and condemnation. Now, the realists admit freely that there's no realistic union between Christ and those justified in Him. There wasn't some unified Christological substance, and we're all individualizations or anything like that. No realistic union there. Thus, on the realist approach, there's a great difference between the kind of union involved in the relationship between Adam and men and women in Him and the kind of union involved in the relationship between Christ and men and women in Him. And yet that parallelism, looking there again, instituted between Christ and Adam would seem to be seriously weakened if the kind of union involved in the one case were utterly different from the kind of union involved in the other. Mary talks about the analogy being at the point of the MO, the modus operandi. Now, if God's modus operandi, way of working, is so utterly different, isn't that something that the analogy would not have alerted us to? You can read Mary's development of that point on three pages, 33 to 35, in the book Imputation. But then moving quickly, and most basic of all, is the point I already referred to, and that is the ascriptural nature of this whole realist argument. Just putting it most simply, what evidence does the Scripture provide for the theory of an invisible unified substance called human nature, which existed in its entirety in Adam and gets individualized in all the individuals in the race? It can't be found. Now, Huckema appeals to Hebrews 7, 9 and 10, the verse I already mentioned. Levi, Abraham, Melchizedek. And Huckema says that's a proof text for realism. It's not. Levi was not in Abraham's loins in a realist sense. And actually, at various points in his discussion, Huckema seems to me to confuse realistic union with biological union. He says that he wants to combine the insights of both representative union, which we haven't come to yet, and realist union. He wants to bring those together. But it seems to me that what he's bringing together is both representative union and biological union. And the fact is, no exponent of representative union has ever wanted to deny the reality of biological union. And not just a reality, but its importance. You'll find John Murray saying that the one is correlative to the other, which I take to mean something like this. It was appropriate that God choose the first father, genealogically, of the race to be the covenant head of the race. So these two have never been thought of as, take your pick, do you want biological union to be affirmed or representative union? All covenant theologians have always wanted to affirm, when they affirm representative union, to affirm both. So I submit that Huckema's suggestion that he's bringing together two kind of conflicting views so that he can rise above the dilemma, Birkhauer's phrase, not really doing that. I don't think that's presenting any new thought. For example, John Murray writes on page 23 of Imputation, "We may not presume to say that the solidarity of the race with Adam, by reason of which all are involved in his sin, could have been true if he had not been the father of all mankind. Whatever additional principle of solidarity may be posited or established, it cannot be abstracted from the fact of biological ancestry." So Murray's pretty clear. He says we all have to affirm biological union, whatever else we say. So it took me a while in reading Huckema to figure out what was going on, as he said he was going to combine realism and representative union. And I think I'm right. That's what he's really doing. He's confusing realism with biological union. So we ought to, before we leave one another today, come to the truth, right? I mean, you can't leave this with the untruth. So let's look on the outline at what is now letter C. Yeah, that's right. It really is. Letter C, small c. So the transparency's right at this point, somehow. Representative union, federalist union. This is the view that you're, I would hope, by this point in your Reformed theological career, familiar with, that says that the relationship between Adam and the race was a relationship specially constituted by God. That's the key, I think. It's a relationship specially constituted by God, not simply a natural relationship, but a divinely ordered, divinely ordained relationship. in which Adam is made, so to speak, Adam is made the representative head of the race. Again, saying that is not to deny the natural relationship, the biological relationship. The two are correlative. But now we're talking about that which is not simply a natural relationship, but one that God institutes sovereignly. Birkhauer, who we've seen expresses such concern that the representative view will leave men with an alien guilt, actually presents the representative or federalist view quite well, I think, when he describes it this way, and I quote from page 456. "The sin of Adam is not imputed to all men in the sense of a human whimsicality, but only because of the bond of community which exists by God's own ordinance. God does not impute an alien guilt, but treats all men as partners in Adam." Interesting that Birkhauer, who has said the problem with representative union is that it leaves men with the idea that their guilt is the guilt of somebody else, not them, is fair enough, let me put it that way, with the representative position, that when he describes it, he can describe it that way. God does not impute an alien guilt, but treats all men as partners in Adam. Hence, he notes on page 457, hence the impassioned rebuttal of federalism to the realist charge of arbitrariness. And indeed, any federalist is going to, with passion, rebut the charge that he is picturing a God who arbitrarily holds men accountable for a sin which is not theirs. John Murray presents us with an example of such an impassioned rebuttal to the realist charge. Page 72, very important, I think, statement, where Murray says on page 72, "God's judgment is always according to truth, and what he reckoned as having occurred did actually occur." If God reckons it to be fact that I have transgressed, it's because I have transgressed. Now, the reason why I have transgressed is because of that covenantal relationship. But still, because of that covenantal relationship being very, if I may use the term, real, but not in the realist sense, it's not a legal fiction. It is truth. Now, that statement I quoted from Murray on page 72 appears right before his discussion of Charles Hodge's setting off reatus paeni from culpa. I don't know why theologians at some of these points think they have to speak in Latin as though it's going to help us. Do you all feel helped? Okay. But here's where, and I'm not getting into this with you really at any length in class, but here's the section of the book that I think you're going to find very interesting, where Murray describes Hodge's view that because of our relationship to Adam, we are, properly, liable to punishment. We are held liable for the punishment falling upon Adam's sin. But Hodge insisted, we are not, therefore, held guilty. Culpa. And Murray gets a little excited at that point. If you can ever, from Murray's writings, kind of read his excitement into it. He's very formal or orderly. In saying something to this effect, that is impossible. That's an atrocious idea. How can God ever condemn to punishment someone who's not guilty? God doesn't do that. If I'm punished for this sin, it's because it's my sin. It's in that discussion that Murray insists on this. And here's another one of these sentences that I think is very important. This is on page 86, and this is, I guess, at least two sentences. Page 86, where Murray insists that, in respect of posterity, Adam's trespass was both peccatum alienum and peccatum proprium. Because of the relationship between Adam and those in Adam in covenant relationship, Adam's trespass was not one or the other, not either the sin of another or the sin of me, proprium, my own sin, but both. It's the sin of Adam in a sense in which it's not mine, but in another very real sense, it is mine. The next sentence I wanted to read is this. We must insist on the involvement in the category of sin and yet maintain that it was Adam's trespass in a manner that is not ours. Now, how could you support the view of representative covenant federal union from Scripture? Why, you've already anticipated the answer to that from the analogy that Paul presents between Adam and Christ. All would concede, all Bible believers would concede, well, maybe that's saying a little too much, all Reformed theologians would concede that Christ is representative head, that the union between Christ and his people upon which the justification of God's people is based is representative. It's not seminal, biological. It's not realistic. It is representative, covenantal. Now, if that's true on that side of the analogy, is it not a natural inference that it was true on the other side, in the case of Adam and those in him? Again, back to this transparency, and especially 1 Corinthians 15, 45 and following. Paul sums up in 1 Corinthians 15, beginning at verse 45, all of God's dealings with men under two great heads. All God's dealings with men summed up under two heads, Adam and Christ. And it's very interesting the way he does it there, you see. He says there's none before Adam because he calls Adam the first man, verse 45. If Adam's the first man, there's no man before him. And there's none between Adam and Christ because Christ is the second man, verse 47. And there's no one in this sense after Christ, because Christ is the last man, verse 45. Very interesting qualifiers that are used there. Adam's the first, Christ is the second, and the last. Adam and Christ sustain unique relationships to man. And it seems in keeping with that emphasis of the Apostle Paul to see a certain similarity between those two relationships, to see that they both involve representative union. Now we know that in Romans 5, the same parallelism is presented, and in verse 14 of Romans 5, we read the express statement, Adam was a type of Christ. Tupas tu melantos. Adam was a type of the one who was to come, and we know that's Christ. Now, if Adam was a type of Christ, working backwards again, if Christ's obedience is reckoned ours because he's our covenant head, our representative head, then it seems that the conclusion would naturally be that Adam's disobedience was reckoned ours because he sustained the same kind of relationship to us, namely that of covenant representative headship. Now that brings us to just kind of almost a footnote on the outline, corporate personality, which Murray doesn't deal with, and I thought I would just say a word about it because of especially Berkauer's great fondness for that position. My talk about maximum and minimums, you know, Paul's view in 2 Corinthians 5. My maximum for today was to look at corporate personality. We would have done it if we didn't start 10 minutes late, I'm sure. But my minimum was to get to this point. So who knows, we may yet, Lord willing, make it to completion of everything that we ought to have before us. Of the nature of our union with Adam. Remember I said that John Murray says there are only two views there that are really worth your consideration. the view of realism and the view of representative or covenantal union. But I've added as letter D now at that point some reference to corporate personality, because Birkhauer certainly remains unconvinced that the Federalist view, the representative view, he's unconvinced that that can do justice to the concept of original sin as my own sin, peccatum proprium. And Birkhauer thinks the proper view will be found in terms of the modern insight into the Hebrew concept of so-called corporate personality. Now that term, corporate personality, was originally employed by the Baptist Old Testament scholar H. Wheeler Robinson, and you find his original article entitled The Hebrew Conception, The Hebrew Conception of Corporate Personality, in a book with a German title. You have it there on the transparency, Werden und Wesen des Alten Testamentum. It was published back in 1936, and this article is pages 49 to 62. But now you can find it more conveniently in a book that was published just in 1980 by Fortress Press with the title Corporate Personality in Ancient Israel. That same chapter is reprinted in that book. Corporate Personality in Ancient Israel, 1980. Robinson uses, he says, the term corporate with the definition of corporation in English law in view. And he gives this definition of corporate in English law, a corporation. A body corporate legally authorized to act as a single individual. A corporation is a body corporate legally authorized to act as a single individual. And Robinson says that in the Hebrew conception, legal prescription was replaced by the fact or fiction of the blood tie. The whole group, including its past, present, and future members, might function as a single individual. Robinson says, through any one of those members conceived as representative of that group. Now, Robinson emphasizes what he calls the characteristic realism of this conception. Not realism in the philosophical sense, but he just means this isn't a mere personification. This isn't just a figure of speech. The group is viewed as a real entity, actualized in its members. And he insists, and I quote, the Hebrew conception is neither a literary personification nor an ideal. Now it seems to me that Robinson's emphases can perhaps help us to understand better the relationship between Adam and the race, as along the lines of the relationship between a representative and the corporation. Perhaps there's some truth in the fact that that can be helpful. But my problem is that I don't see how meaningfully this corporate personality position differs from the traditional representative position, Federalist position. Aside from Robinson's notion, apparently, that any member of the group might act as its representative, a notion that certainly does not do justice to the unique position occupied by Adam. Aside from that element, and I'm not sure, maybe I haven't really understood Robinson accurately there, but he seems to be saying something like that. But aside from that, the language employed by advocates of the corporate personality theory seems essentially, to me, identical to the language employed by the advocates of historic federalism. For example, Robinson quotes S.A. Cook to this effect, and I quote, Hebrew thought refers with equal facility to a representative individual or to the group he represents. Hebrew thought refers with equal ease, facility, to a representative individual or to the group he represents. And then Robinson continues, "The most familiar of all examples of this representative value is seen in the thoroughly Hebraic contrast of Adam and Christ made by the Apostle Paul." Notice he says that's a thoroughly Hebraic idea of the two representative heads, going on with the quotation, "which contrast draws all its cogency from the conception of corporate personality. As in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive." In similar fashion, Stieg Hansen, in his book entitled The Unity of the Church in the New Testament, refers to C.H. Dodd's exegesis of Romans 5, 12 and following as being the corporate personality concept. And then he describes the resulting interpretation of Dodd as follows, and I quote this fairly long paragraph. But what I want you to pick up on here is how many times the word representative, represents, appears in this chapter. The point I'm making is I don't see why one would get all excited about corporate personality concept is that totally different from the representative view. Seems to me it's another way of saying it. But here, anyway, is Stieg Hansen's summary of Dodd's exegesis of Romans 5, 12 and following. "As a chief represents and includes his tribe in his person, thus Adam represents humanity as its first fruits and head. Similarly, Christ is a corporate personality by including a new race, doing and suffering as the inclusive representative of the church. From the aspect of representation, the individual and the collective body are identical. Hence, there is an identity of representation between Adam and the human race. The fundamental importance to Paul of the thought of representation, mankind as a corpus of Adam have sinned by the fall of their representative, verse 12. But for that reason, all need not have sinned individually, verse 14. If he acted as their representative, the consequence must also be that his lot and conditions become their lot and conditions. Nay, their whole nature has become identical with his, 1 Corinthians 15, verses 47 to 49. To an Adam collectivity corresponds a Christ collectivity, which, it is true, has an entirely different character, but is anyhow conceived according to the same pattern as the former. The Christian may benefit from what Christ, as a representative, has accomplished for the good of the new humanity." Now, as I say, that's quoted as a summary of a corporate personality view of Romans 5, 12 and following. I counted them up, and there are nine uses of the term representative or represents in that paragraph. And so the question I would ask is, how do such conclusions differ meaningfully from the historic Federalist view? Birkhauer writes, and I quote, "On the surface, of course," notice, "on the surface, of course, there seems to be a greater affinity between the corporative and the representative ideas." And the comparison he's making, greater affinity, is in a context where he's been talking also about realism. His point is to say that on the surface, this corporate personality view seems to have closer affinity with the representative, covenantal understanding than with the realist understanding that, you remember, Birkhauer has been expressing sympathy for. But I would submit that the affinity is not merely on the surface. Birkhauer wants to stress that in the corporate personality view, the involvement of the whole group in the sin of the one representative is, and I quote him, page 514, "very real." The involvement of the whole group in the sin of the one representative on the corporate personality view, that involvement is very real. But Birkhauer himself admits that the proponents, I quote again, have not meant a realism as we find in such figures as Shedd and Graydonis. And it seems to me that Berkauer simply does not do justice to the reality, if you want to call it that, to the reality of the race's involvement in Adam's sin in the view of one like John Murray or any other good representative of the covenantal representative position. I remind you again of Murray's insistence that, quote, page 72 in Imputation, God's judgment is always according to truth, and what he reckoned as having occurred did actually occur. You see, there's no mere as if there. The involvement of the group in the action of the representative, if you want to use Berkauer's words, is viewed there as very real. I fear that the fact is, when you get down to it, that Berkauer is seeking to deny in some way any notion of, as he puts it, explanation or causality in the relationship between Adam and his posterity, and he thinks he finds an ally in the concept of corporate personality. If you were wondering why all Berkauer's enthusiasm for the corporate personality insight, that, I'm sure, is the answer. He thinks it will be an ally in his desire to get away from the idea that in this notion of Adam and the race, there is any explanation for our being sinners, any causality involved. Here's what Berkauer writes. It seems obvious to us that Paul had a corporate idea in mind when he looked at both Adam and Christ. At the same time, that very corporativity can never have the character of an explanation. That's on page 516. And now this from page 523. It is very obvious that every explanation of guilt in the history of theology must lead us to a self-excuse. So reading what we do in Paul about Adam is not at all an explanation of the reality of sin. And then this on page 530. It is manifest that the church's confession has differed immensely from the notion of a fatal calamity or a natural and self-evident inheritance of evil to the doctrine of original sin. The doctrine of original sin has nothing to do with a legacy or a heritage which comes upon us willy-nilly, come what may. Notice all the emotionally charged terms there. These references to a legacy that comes upon us willy-nilly, come what may. Berkauer goes on, that's not the church's confession. It is not isolated from our own action. Page 530. But again, I would point out to you that even those proponents of corporate personality whom Berkauer cites do not really support him in that denial of the notion that there is something of an explanation here for our being sinners, being guilty sinners, and being those with a sinful nature. None of the corporate personality representatives that he cites, it seems to me, really are making the denial that he makes. Review again Hansen's summary of Dodd's interpretation of Romans 5:12 and following, and note how clear is the concept of causality or consequence. Jean Dufresne, the Jesuit that I've mentioned early in this semester. Boy, this semester's gone fast, hasn't it? I know it's hard to have so much of me every day, but look on the bright side. You'd have 13 weeks if this were in a normal semester. Now tomorrow it's all over. See, that's the bright side. Anyway, Jean Dufresne is another one whose, quote, detailed study of the corporate personality notion is appealed to by Berkauer. But after noting that Dufresne, quote, affirms that in the inclusion of all in Adam, there is also a certain influence which Adam exerts on all, and thus a certain causality, Berkauer has to add, quote, but it seems to us that this idea of causality introduces a foreign element in the concept of a corporate personality. But you see, Berkauer never really explains why The idea of causality is foreign to the notion of corporate personality. He says that Dufresne's bringing the notion of consequence or causality into the picture is foreign to the notion of corporate personality, and yet it seems to be present in all the representatives of corporate personality that he quotes. So I'm not at all clear why he says it's a foreign element. Still less does Berkauer explain why it is foreign to a passage like Genesis 3 or Romans 5. Now, you have to be thinking clearly at this point, and I realize we haven't even gotten into the element that I think Berkauer is using to confuse people. But it is indeed a mystery, and we're going to come to say it today, Lord willing. It is indeed a mystery how sin could enter a universe absolutely controlled by an all-holy God. And it is a mystery how the first man created in knowledge, righteousness, and true holiness could sin. We're going to emphasize those mysteries. It is a mistake, however, to put our relationship to Adam in this same category of mystery. That's just to confuse things.